Dr. Andrew Mills. Research interests focus mainly on Pacific art history and the social cultural history of Oceania since 1700. The anthropology of art and material culture studies, museology, and the history of particularly ethnographic collections in Europe since the 18th century. The art history of the Pacific Islands, and more specifically Polynesia and Western Polynesia during the period 1700 to 1980. Although his interests in Pacific art are broad and general, he specializes in the study of historical textiles and wood sculpture and have particular love for the arts of Tonga and Fiji. He's interested in the cultural dynamics of interaction between different Pacific people, particularly in terms of trade style, religious practices, and warfare. He also has interests in early European exploration and influence in the Pacific, Christian missionary activity, British colonialism, and the contemporary Pacific arts scene. And through the current AHRC-funded project situating Pacific backcloth production in place, he is conducting research into the historical manufacture, style, and use of this important and beautiful non-woven fabric in Polynesia. Our team are using a novel combination of Pacific art history, materials, science, and conservation science to answer long-standing questions about the materials, style, production, techniques, deterioration, and care of historical bark cloth collections. And without further ado,
I want to say thank you very much to Darren Kamai for inviting us here from the University of Glasgow, and to Billy for arranging this. Very exciting to be here. At the University of Glasgow, Francis Leonard and I are working on a project called Tapa, Situating Pacific Bark Cloth in Time and Place. And we're hoping to look at the materials and the pigments that are used to produce tapa, to try and identify some of the less resolved questions about how historical tapa was made. And the short books are incredibly useful for this for lots of different reasons. But the most obvious one is that most tapa in museum collections was bought or donated from the open market or from a Palangi, a Western collector, without an understanding of when it was made, and generally decades after it was made. So in terms of how we place these particular textiles in time, it's extremely difficult to work from most museum collections. That's the first thing. It's also the case that tapa rarely lasts, unless specific efforts are made to do so, it rarely lasts longer than 10 to 20 years in a normal tropical environment, and it will decay and fall apart. So in some ways, strangely, the fact that these wonderful cloths were taken to the cold, inhospitable climates of England is actually, has had a strange kind of effect in preserving them peculiarly. So that's another thing. And that tapa was changing in style over time and would continue to change after this is obvious to all of us now. We all know that all textiles go through stylistic changes and fashion comes in and comes out. But when Cook's crew were in the Pacific, they didn't necessarily make those connections. They didn't necessarily make those connections about how their own material culture was changing. And I don't think that they necessarily attributed that kind of quality to the Pacific Islanders. And it's always been a kind of a pernicious problem, I think, in the early European encounters with non-European peoples, is that they didn't necessarily understand that when they were making those first recordings and making those first collections of objects, they didn't understand that this was a very specific historical moment, and they thought, oh, well, this place has been like this, and all of the things that people make in this place have been like this for centuries, which is obviously nonsense. But people therefore didn't record what had happened. People didn't say, oh, what's different? What was your grandmother making? What kind of cloth was your grandmother making? And so on and so forth. So we don't know. We don't know the art historical chronology of textile manufacture. Or we didn't, certainly, in Polynesia. So Because the shore book contain some of the earliest known tablets still in existence, and we know that they must have been, or very probably were, collected between 1768 and 1779, because virtually no other tapper got to England after that for quite a long period of time, they're uniquely valuable. Uniquely valuable for reconstructing the art history of tapper making in Tahiti and Hawaii and in Tonga. And the main way that they're useful is that we can compare the style of cloths in these albums to later cloths that were collected and see how they're different, basically. So Tahitian cloths, the main thing that we can say about the Tahitian cloths in the shore books is a huge diversity of different kinds of cloths, incredibly fine. Some of the finest tapa that was ever made, literally a fifth of a millimetre thick, incredibly, incredibly beautiful diaphanous cloth, and a huge diversity of different kinds of cloth, paper mulberry and in breadfruit. And we see a wide range of them. We also see this incredible, an example here, and the album is open at a page which has a piece on it, this incredible recycled Tahitian cloth, multiple layers of cloth that once the cloth had been used once, it was then recombined and re-beaten to produce the softest possible cloth that you can imagine. So very, very beautiful. And also we see the finest linear beta marks of all beta marks, all central Polynesian tapa beta marks. So more than 12 grooves per centimetre. It's almost impossible to understand how the Tahitian bark cloth beaters were manufactured and engraved with such precision at that time, really. But only the Tahitian bark cloth beaters that were collected in the 18th century are of that fineness, and only the Tahitian bark cloth that was collected in the 18th century is of that fineness as well. So we see, to some extent, a decline in the fineness of manufacture afterwards. So that's a particular distinctive thing that we've learned about, particularly from the shore books, being able to fix the style of certain cloths in time. And then we see this distinctively Tahitian characteristic of this beautiful red pigment, the mati dye. Red mati dye, which is produced in a very unique and incredibly interesting way that we're trying to research more at the moment. But we only see circular designs, C-shaped designs, and X-shaped designs, and S-shaped designs from bamboo stamps. So what we understand, what you'll see if you go and look in the art history of Polynesia books about, or the tapa books, you'll see these beautiful cloths which have fern leaf printing on them, which are incredibly beautiful, from the early 19th century. But we don't find any of those in the shore books because that kind of cloth wasn't made. So it's an interesting thing in that regard. And we also see a huge, vast diversity of Hawaiian cloths, a really kind of almost bewildering range of different kinds of textiles. And so Hawaiian kapa cloth is famous, as I say here, for complex beta marks. You know, what we see is these fantastically complex marks that when you hold a cloth up to the light and light's transmitted through, you can see grids with little dots, little net patterns, and so on and so forth, different geometric patterns, incredibly beautiful. It's one of the defining features of Hawaiian kapa, but we don't see that in any of the Hawaiian kapa in the shore books. So it's very interesting. They have linear beta marks, the same as tapa cloth from Tahiti and from the Cook Islands and so on and so forth. But we don't see these complex marks because it's a 19th century development. And that's something which is really interesting. What it suggests is that, as I say here, as elsewhere in Polynesia, that Hawaiian bark cloth beaters got more complicated and were more complexly engraved later on in time, which is probably a result of the importation of steel tools. In the same way that we see with Tongan clubs, we see this kind of explosion in Tongan club engraving from the 1780s onwards, because as soon as the carvers get the tools, then they can do much more elaborate things, and they immediately start doing much more elaborate things. So that's quite interesting, but in this very first collection, we don't see that. And it's a similar situation, as I say, with printed designs using kapala, these little bamboo stamps. that the Hawaiians have used forever, as far as we know, to produce beautiful printed designs like this. Now, what you'll see in 1820s Hawaiian bark cloth is you'll see complex little carved patterns that are used in repeating patterns and are articulated together to produce beautiful little designs that repeat and repeat and repeat. What we see in the Shore Book is we see incredibly complicated designs, but we only see liner stamps, we only see linear rectangular stamps used in different ways to produce a whole huge range of different things. But the style of the cloth and its printing is entirely different to what we see even 40 years later, which is very, very interesting. So, as I say, takeaway, Hawaiian kapa making was enriched by steel tools, surprisingly, but a lot of the diversity of cloth types was lost, because what we see later on is we see the same kind of cloth used again and again and again, basically. We don't see this huge different range of things. We don't see materials that we aren't even entirely sure what they are. And one of the things that we're trying to do in our project is take samples from 18th century cloths like these, very, very small samples, and have them analysed so that we can identify what species they are. Anyway, thank you. Now, the tonal cloths are quite difficult to talk about, actually, because as Billy was saying, there actually aren't very many Tongan samples in comparison to the Tahitian samples and the Hawaiian samples within the Shore Books, and usually they are really quite simple and quite similar to each other. So the thing that this makes me suspect is that Shore actually didn't acquire very many Tongan cloths. You may have only had one or two Tongan cloths at the most. And we don't see, you know, we don't see the classic overpainting with tui-tui with their candle nut infused coca with candle nut infused resin paint, which is a really important part of modern Tongan ngātu production, but also in the 19th century was a very important part. We don't see so much of that. So mostly what we see is we see the patterns that have been impressed into the cloth when the cloth was built together on the papa at the time, on the production table, if you like, at the time when the cloth was put together and pasted together. We see the kupesi designs, but we don't see a lot of the elaborate overpainting. There are also, as Wani Vase has discussed in her recent book on Tongan bark cloth, available in all good bookshops. Nothing to do with that. There are no figurative kupesi, so you know, if you go and look at the at all of the books on on Tongan bark cloth and on bark cloth of Polynesia, the distinctive thing that people always say about Tongan bark cloth is there are these wonderful pictorial kupesi, beautiful pictures of the royal palace and the halapaini, the row of pines and so on and so forth. These are pictorial images. None of those things are there in 18th century Ngātu. It's very, very interesting. And also, what we see, some of the kupesi, not all of them, most of the kupesi that you see, the patterns in them seem to be constructed in the same way, largely, that we find with 19th century kupesi and so on. But some of them, there are little curvilinear elements that seem to be produced by stitching cordage down, rather than stitching little coconut leaflet midribs down in complex geometric patterns. So it looks like kupesi production might have been more diverse in the 18th century than it maybe became in the 19th century at the moment, but we really need to see more cloths to be able to say that. So that's what we're trying to figure out at the moment anyway.
Cool.